Hey, Angela, how's it going?
Great.
Great? Is it going well? It's one of those weird days. It feels like there's a gas leak in the building or something.
It does. It's the holidays are coming. I'm really excited about eating Thanksgiving stuff.
Oh, yeah. What's your favorite Thanksgiving dish?
Oh, my gosh. I don't have one favorite. Well, actually, I guess it would be a mixture of mashed potatoes with some cream corn on top of it, with some stuffing on top of that, and some green bean casserole for dessert.
Ooh,
yeah. You can just mix it all up. And
yeah, that's I like mashed potatoes and green bean casserole mm-hmm. all mixed together.
Yes, and a roll.
So, got a question for you.
Yeah?
Do you like camping?
Yes, I do.
Would you like camping for, let's say, 3 months? Could you handle that?
I'm not going to lie, no.
On horseback with, about 3,000 head of cattle.
That would be so much fun for the weekend. I could do, like, what was that movie? The City Slickers. Yeah. I could totally do a City Slickers thing. But
trivia, what's City Slickers 2 called?
City Slickers.
The Search for Curly's Gold.
Sorry.
You never saw?
I don't think I saw the second one.
It's like Jack Palance, man. That was his.
I do like Jack Palance, but no, I don't think I saw the second one. Is that something I need to watch?
Yes.
Okay.
Everyone out there tonight. A cinematic classic.
Okay.
Search
from
for
the
Curly's
mouth
Gold.
Of Corey, City Slickers 2 is a cinematic classic.
So, you know, last week we talked about the Chisholm Trail, kind of told you what it was. Today we're going to be talking about being a cowboy.
Yes.
What that actually meant. And it's crazy to think about how much impact this is essentially when cowboy culture like grows out of this entire experience. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to think about how much this period and this cowboy culture affects us today. I mean, we see it everywhere, especially living in Oklahoma and country music.
Yeah.
And OSU Cowboys. I mean, it's all around us, and the cowboy culture that we know of is born from this time.
So what did you think of a cowboy when you were little or growing up? Like, what are your memories of cowboys?
Essentially, it was fun, you know? I didn't really think about it because my generation was more like G.I. Joe. So I didn't have this romanticized. I didn't grow up. We talked about it last. I didn't grow up watching Western shows.
Right.
Other than, like, Young Guns. So it wasn't like actually being a cowboy wasn't part of my.
Yeah.
So I didn't really think about it, but I assumed it was a sweet job where you got to fire guns for some reason. And
yeah. So I'm a few years older, so I got to grow up in the rhinestone cowboy phase.
Ooh, yeah.
Which,
late 70s?
Yes. And I remember watching the Mandrell sisters on TV, the special. And it was the 80s oil boom in Oklahoma. So I remember, like, my parents' friends driving their Cadillacs with their huge cowboy hats and their $1,000 boots and their gold nuggets. And that's kind of like, you know, other than, like, the TV cowboy, that's what I thought of as a cowboy. You listen to, you know, a Conway Twitty and you wear a huge 10-gallon yeah. hat or something.
And you watch Dallas.
Oh, yeah, so. Absolutely.
Well, you know, we wanted to get an idea of what being a cowboy actually meant, what the jobs were, what it was like actually being out on the trail. So we reached out to Don Reeves with the Cowboy Hall of Fame and Western Heritage Museum. Have you been out there lately?
Yeah, I went for a fundraiser event, and it's beautiful.
Were you in the ballroom?
Yes,
Okay, you know that huge ceiling?
Mm-hmm.
When I interned there and I changed light bulbs up there.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, and you're on one of those little
like a forklift kind of thing?
No, or? Not a scissor lift where it's four. One of mm-hmm. the single lifts where it's
no.
Yeah, when you're up there, it
wobbles.
You sway like, whoa. Yeah.
Yeah,
like
I would. I'd have to decline from doing that. But I'll clean the toilets before I do that.
You're in a safety harness,
mm-hmm.
right? Strapped to the device.
But
yeah, so if it falls,
you fall with it.
Yeah.
And then you bang into it.
Yeah, my thinking is like, at least give me a shot to jump out at the right time.
Right.
So,
like a parachute.
I don't know. In my head, if it toppled over, I could time it correctly and roll out and be like, yay. But
yeah.
It would probably just crush me anyway.
That's awful.
Anyway, great museum.
It is a great museum. If you haven't been there, you should definitely check it out.
The barbed wire room?
Barbed wire room. I really enjoy all of, I mean, just looking at the paintings. It is, you know, a lot of Western and landscapes and Native American stuff. And there's a lot of beautiful pieces out there.
What did you think the job of cowboying was?
being in a beautiful outdoor environment and eating delicious beans and cornbread, and every once in a while having to go get a large animal out from the...
Or a stormy night when a stampede comes up, you save the day.
And roping, cool rope trips, and cool rope tricks. I said, I don't know what I said.
Roke?
I think I said rope. I don't know what it is.
Like I said, there's a gas leak in the building today.
What did you think Cowboy was?
Yeah, just being cool up there on the horse, trotting along slow, watching the camping out under the stars. You look up and it's just gorgeous.
Singing cowboy songs around the campfire?
Basically, Blazing Saddles. I don't know. That movie was probably like the only Western cowboy. I had that experience more than, I don't know. Good movie, Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, but I could see how that would corrupt your idea of what a cowboy was.
One of the guest stars of Blazing Saddles next to Gene Wilder is Cleavon Little, who is from Chickasha, Oklahoma. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And would you say a guest star?
I don't know. What do you mean? Guest starring? Yeah. I think they're the two main starring roles.
Okay.
And he's a guest. No, he's not a guest star.
Well, because I think a guest would be a show.
Co-star. Let's get Don in here and talk with him and figure out what being a cowboy was actually about.
Sounds good.
So, glad to be here this morning.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Don. Let's dive right in. Talking about what did it mean to be a cowboy on the Chisholm Trail? I know that's kind of a broad question, but can you kind of shape the question for us?
Well, yeah, I love perspective in history. Mm-hmm. And like the cowboy is an icon, but it's also trying to deal with it. We're talking about something, the discussion here, the 150th anniversary of the Chisholm Trail. That's a long period. You know, and so a lot of people come through the state of Oklahoma and say, well, what was it like back when there were cowboys? And I said, have you got off the highway? They're still breathing and working and riding horses and roping. And so it's 2017, 150 years later. And back in 1867, when we look back at when Joseph McCoy tried to, a cattleman from, or a buyer, a stock farmer from Illinois, tried to get commercial enterprise going up in Abilene, Kansas, that in the fall of that year, and then on through really is 1868 when it really got going. That was a different world, a different time. The country, I don't think we can even understand today as a country. We've not gone through the desolation of war, I don't think at all, since the Civil War. Texas was not a big battleground, but yet so much of its resources and of its people and men, the state in that way economically was devastated, and the cattle industry was disturbed and let go fallow. In other words, the cattle just roamed wild because there were not enough people to watch them or to gather them. In terms of the Chisholm Trail and cowboying, as they like to use it as a verb now, which I kind of get a kick out of, then coming across Indian Territory to get up into where the railheads, as they're called, where the railroad stops, and so you can meet the railroad there to deliver your cattle. Indian Territory was quite devastated by the war, and the tribes were split, several of them in the middle, fighting on each side, and a lot of the places in the state were quite disturbed. So it's hard for us to understand what 1867 in Oklahoma was really like. It was a hard place, and a lot of people were still trying to get back on their feet or were still in bad straits.
So as this market opened up for cattle in the East, and I think I read that there was $4 for a head of cattle in Texas because the market was just so saturated. Who were these people that actually worked these cattle drives?
Yeah, who were cowboys? Like, who would be a cowboy? Where did they come from?
Both those wrap into one great question. And again, that's, I apologize, but go back to the perspective. As it changed a great deal from 1867, 1866 to even the end of what we would call the Chisholm Trail period, 1884, when you pretty well needed to drive cattle west of Kansas. At that point in time, when they were trying to get the cattle industry, the range industry, and find cattle, that you couldn't you couldn't drive cattle to the market unless you had cattle. And so there were cattle all over parts of Texas. You just had to gather them up, and sometimes it was hard to tell. It's hard for us to conceive of in 4 years there were a lot of cattle that were unmarked, you know, because they had not been gathered and branded. So they didn't really know whose they were. They actually called them cow hunts at that point. Now we come to later on talk about roundups, mm-hmm. which usually has to deal with a certain ranch, or before that when you had situations where your cattle were released and you had people can drive around. They know their area, and essentially is you would have cattle would stay in a watershed. Cattle like grass, and they need water, and they need water every day. And compared to us, they need a lot of water. And so the watershed means that's where the rain and the natural water all flows down to a central point, you know, mostly a creek or a river if possible, and it runs on down somewhere else. The cattle would rarely, if they had plenty there, they wouldn't climb up and go over that ridge to another area. So they had plenty to eat and plenty of water there. So
they would just kind of stay in that
drainage basin or that valley. And so that's how... It doesn't make sense to a lot of people when they say the cattlemen would have open range and they just let the cattle go. They understood the natural tendencies of the cattle. So that's what you had in Texas. You had a lot of that, and you had a lot of open area where the cattle were far few, and so they would have to go and seek them. And the people, again, it was a devastated time and area. People were coming back as veterans, coming back from where they were in the country at that time. And say they might have had family still in the business. They might not have any family left in Texas. And so you had a lot of refugees, as we would almost look at them, mm-hmm. People who, for the cattle industry, would actually be kind of old for this, you know, in their 30s, late 20s. And then the owners, the fathers and stuff in their 40s and 50s. To me now, sounds very young. But that was old for the time and the place. And so you had kind of a ragamuffin group that would be trying to form. If they said, okay, well, we'll see what we can gather, is the term they would, what we can gather and see if we can take them to market.
Do you think is there a correlation between the kind of going through warfare? Because most of the men would have seen some combat, and the hardiness of the cowboy?
Absolutely. Great question. And especially on a cattle drive. A lot of soldiers, especially in the Civil War, you didn't leave your barracks and go out and fight for maybe a year, maybe 3 years at a time. They never saw the inside of a building. People don't realize now, and one of the things as a curator for a museum of the cowboy world, that's one of the things that's hardest for me to get across to people, is it's an outdoor occupation. It's an outdoor world. And one of the main differences between today and the last 100 years almost is the fact that in that earlier time, these are people who lived in the elements and literally had to put up with that every day. And if it was raining, they got wet. If it was raining at night, they slept in the rain. And that's what you had, these hardened soldiers, and also in terms of the hardships of life, but also in terms of they had kind of short fuse probably. And so in terms of conflict with other people or getting through challenges, they were pretty tough bunch, and they could take it on. If they knew and they had invested, they could if the cattle were four or maybe only worth a dollar back in parts of Texas, and they knew they could increase that tenfold up in Kansas, and they would get a percentage of that. They were looking at nothing or being able to do that and reestablish something for their family. Or maybe they didn't have any. Maybe they're coming in from Tennessee, didn't have any family left, mm-hmm. and they were looking for a new life. But they're a pretty hard bitten bunch. Not talking about just white Civil War veterans, white soldiers. There were blacks, ex African slaves, mm-hmm. People of Hispanic descent in Texas. There was quite a variety of people involved in that, and this opened a door to where there was a possibility of a new life.
And we have this like romantic idea, or I do anyways, from the movies and television, that is just this young, adventurous boy, living in the dirty streets of Boston who wants to go out and, you know, get some fresh air and, you know, and so it's kind of, it's really interesting to see the perspective, especially the Civil War aspect of it. I never even thought about that, that these are people, these are war veterans.
You can't say all of them, but you, in terms of the available people, again, you didn't have any 18-year-old women doing this.
Right.
Yeah. One thing they would not be looked upon. It wasn't a womanly thing to do. It was a very hard thing to do. Mm-hmm. So it's the same way you'd have the great sailing ships on the Atlantic. You didn't have any single 18-year-old women out there either.
Right.
You know, it was a hard male's world. But they weren't all Civil War soldiers or ex-slaves. You had quite a kaleidoscope of people. But in that early time, after the Civil War, until at least 1870, you had so many displaced people that and they were moving around. They're trying to find a new life. They're trying to take advantage of the fact that you had all these unclaimed cattle in Texas, or cattle that needed to be claimed in Texas in certain areas and taken to market. Mm-hmm. That you had a higher percentage of men, not all of them single, but you know, needing work and needing, it's economics.
Right.
It's like when I talk to school groups and stuff like that, they're looking for, okay, I decided I'm going to be a cowboy if you read the books, what are you going to be when you grow up? I'm going to be a cowboy and I'm going to well, these are people who are just trying to figure out, well, I can make this amount of money if I do this.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Oklahomans understand this and say, well, I'll go work in the oil field for a year.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll bank that money and I'll go to college.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
You know, possibility of making more money. It's a risk. You know, I don't know. Maybe 1 in 10, 2 in 10 died. There were a lot of elements that could sneak up and cause physical harm or death on this kind of adventure. So it was a tough world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of the thought about, if I can go on to think about the young man and a teenager's world.
Mm-hmm.
So you had from 66 up to 1870, you had an influx of people trying to find themselves, trying to find a new life, trying to start a ranch. And if they could move cattle up there and they could end up with a couple $1,000, they could come back and they could start a ranch. Well, they're not going to want to, you know, risk their life again if they can start a new ranch with a wife or somewhere on the Sabine in Texas. They're going to stay there. But by 1870 and further on, you started to have the formation of actual trail driving companies.
Okay.
Where ranches would get together and say, well, you know, we hear that you can make this much money if you sent that much cattle up per head or whatever. We've got X number. We've got 150 head that we'd like to move. They would actually, just like truck drivers.
Ranchers,
Like Leeway Freight. Of a time. They would say, well, we'll on shares is one way they talked about it. They would provide to this group, to this company, this many head of cattle. There'd be a contract, and that sometimes the trail company would pay that rancher right then, betting on the come that they hope to make that much, and if they lose the cattle, it's on them. Mm-hmm. And the ranchers is saying, well, okay, if I've got money in hand, it's worth, you know, I don't know how it's going to come out on the road. He gets their money, or they go back and say, well, okay, I'll pay you X upon delivery, and I'll give you the money when I get back. Anyway, there was business deals like that. They say over time, they've come up with historians. Of course, historians are always right.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They know exactly what happened. You know, I wouldn't make fun if I wasn't one. It seems to be the average was about 2,500 head that were gathered. So sometimes
for a drive,
it economical.
Right, okay.
To get a crew together of a trail boss, 10 cowboys,
drive 30
a cook.
Cattle.
Yeah, it wouldn't economically pay off. And you can't drive 10,000 either because you can't
Which
make
is
it
too
work.
Much, yeah.
So the model by the 1870, the early 1870s, they kind of got it down. This is what it would take to drive cattle from central Texas to mid-Kansas at the minimum, sometimes maybe on to Nebraska, depending on the market, Omaha. Mm-hmm. But it came to be about, you know, one person in charge, the trail boss, you know, say that, about 10 men, a cook, and at least one wagon. And they figured out, okay, we can make this work. It's an you had to come up with an economic model.
Yeah.
To where you're fairly certain you could make money. Up to the 1870s, it was rolling the dice.
Yeah, just experimentation, and then you find a system that works best.
The interesting thing, if I can go back, and one thing that gets you to that point, is that in that early time, right after the Civil War, until about the 1870s, and the trail driving that actually happened before the Civil War, they were families moving the cattle. And it was a long-standing English tradition. Mm-hmm. They were usually called drovers, not cowboys. Mm-hmm. That term, it's a long discussion how that word came about, but they were driving cattle, and the English term is drovers. In fact, when Joseph McCoy opened the market there in Abilene, he established Drover's Cottage, and that's where the drovers were encouraged to stay and rent a hotel room from him. Over at the museum, the National Cowboy Museum that I involved with, Jack Bailey had a handwritten pencil journal that we were able to obtain from 1868, August to November 1868. And in that, there were several families involved, several working hands, majority of them Southern white, some of black cowboys, and one Mexican. So it's interesting. You get these kind of ratios that start to come out. They had several wagons. It was kind of a motley crew from what mm-hmm. we would look at it now. I said, mm-hmm. that's not how they did cattle drives there. Who had the check wagon? Well, they would just kind of, you know, a lot of it they had to gather the food as they went. Sometimes there was beef that was injured and could be slaughtered, things like that, or they buy things on the way. In time, they started having, again, it became that conventional. So if you put this one wagon together and you put all the mm-hmm. cooking equipment together mm-hmm. in a certain way, it was very efficient. You could move, set it up, move.
Figured out the system to go by.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And, you know, it could be handled by one man, you know, mm-hmm. type of thing. But at that point in time, earlier on, you didn't have that. And really, right in 1866, and with the cow hunts and with the early drives, some of what that would be called greasy sack outfits were out there. I love that.
Yeah, what's a
greasy
outfit?
Sack outfit? Doesn't that conjure up, you know, this nice, clean cowboy in a pinstripe shirt, you know? That was a pretty frontier bunch. And what would happen is there was no chuck wagon. There was no cook. And a lot of times on the frontier, you know, if you headed out, you had a bag and you'd have some hardtack in it, some flour and water, and it ended up being a biscuit that you mm-hmm. could, you know, throw as far as you could throw a rock. And then salt pork was the classic Texas Southern frontier thing that they could wrap up and put in a bag and just pull it out and chow on. Later on in Texas, more of a Hispanic thing became more popular, which we love today as a jerky. But salt pork, and so as you can imagine, it's like a big slab of bacon.
Yeah.
Okay. It's cured with salt, but it'd be wrapped up in various ways and put on the back of the saddle. And so you'd see some of those close by, and imagine what that wrap looked like after a while in the sun.
Yeah, greasy,
get a little, little hot. Yeah.
It wouldn't be on their back, but it'd be on the behind the saddle, you know. Yeah. And so they were called greasy sack outfits, okay. You know, if they didn't have a wagon that had, you know, that was used for, and that was the military way. They'd have a wagon, they would have their what they could, unless it was just a patrol, they would have their supplies and the cooking equipment and stuff like that on the wagon. But so it progressed quite a bit, you know, over
right,
time.
Right.
So can you break down when the system of the cattle drive really became most efficient? What was the traditional team members and what were their roles?
Yeah, by the mid-1870s, really, that's what's interesting to me. We're celebrating 1867 to 2017, so right when it started, you didn't have this. But after a few years, they figured out this is the most efficient way to make this work and the most efficient way to keep the cattle together. You know, that was the goal. So they would have, about 12 people on a crew. And when they would move out, you had people that would be in the lead, often called point. Not always just trying to find the trail. We think, oh my gosh, if by the 1870s, can you imagine, there were hundreds of thousands of beef that had preceded you, and they did break a trail. It was more a matter of when you led your herd of 2,000 or so animals, you needed to find them two things that day. You needed to move them safely down the road. Bad day would be 8 miles or up to 15 miles that day, but you'd need to be seeking water and grass, because it was a grazing herd process. If the animals didn't leave from the time they left to the time they got there, which is generally, depending on where they were going to stop, about a 2-month trip, you wouldn't have any animals.
Right.
They needed time to eat.
Yeah.
And beef normally need to eat once a day. So those are the two things that point person was trying to, and also coming up through, in particular, we're talking about the Chisholm Trail coming up through Indian Territory. There were a number of rivers and deep creek ravines. One of the best right here in Oklahoma City was the Deep Fork of the Canadian.
Oh.
And it was referenced when these people got to it. Mike, what, you know, the ravine is deep.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing that bothered them is rocky at the bottom. It was hard for the animals
to cross.
Yeah. A lot of this was sandy bottom, you know, the other rivers look like in the area. But there was one book that was written, it was called The Ladder of Rivers. There's essentially 11 of those type of obstacles
to get up into
Kansas.
So the point would maybe, you know, find a low point or depending on.
There were established fords to where it was a cut into the bank. One thing to get down in there, you needed to get the cattle out the other side as well. And so you had someone leading point finding those places. You had flank riders, the majority that was on either side to keep the cattle from drifting. And not staying with the other animals. You would often have a little known hero of the group. You'd have oftentimes a bell cow, and oftentimes it was a cow.
Uh-huh.
It was matriarch, and the other cows or steers would follow that one animal. It was people don't realize that horses in particular, but also beef, have a peer. You know, they know who their elders are and stuff like that.
Right.
And so sometimes you had a lead steer or a cow that would. You would start that animal off, and the others would tend to follow. And then you had other folks that would ride to the back of the group, the back flank, and the drag in the back. Of course, you don't want to lose any out the back.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that's only been on a hike with six or more people realize it doesn't take long to string people.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden you got a straggler back here, you know, a mile away. And for these folks, every one of those beefs is a commodity. The other thing that changed from the early mid 1860s on up to probably not till 1874 or mid 70s is you'd hear reference, and it was confusing for all. You'd say that, well, that wasn't all beef herd. It's like, well, duh, I didn't expect there to be any ducks in the group. but what they'd meant by saying that's Texas for that meant that this is all steers. There's all castrated males.
Okay.
There's all steers.
So just strictly to consume.
Yeah, because, again, follow the money.
Yeah.
The people that were up there in Kansas, or the railroad representatives, or the buyers,
they're not trying to start a cattle ranch.
That's right.
Yeah.
They don't want a breeding pair.
Yeah.
They quickly learned down in Texas what they would get the best money for up here were steers.
Mm-hmm.
And so earlier on, though, in that early 1867 to 1871 period in particular, you would often have the herds would be what they could gather.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have, they probably have more cows and calves and maybe even a few bulls, and some steers in that. But then they just have to see what it would bring up at market. But as they refined the process and the trail driving, it's more efficient if we take them what they want.
Yeah,
we'll get better price per animal. So don't bring, you know, and it's a hard, you know, early on they would lose it. The number of calves could not hold up, and a number of times with storms and other things like that, there were stampedes, and it was harmful for everybody.
Right,
and you would lose some calves and stuff anyway. So.
Can you talk about the chuck wagon and the guy who runs it? The cook, his name's Cookie, and his hat's on sideways, and he's kind of kooky.
Do we have an hour for this? That's one of my favorite subjects. I love it. You know, the chuck wagon festivals we have now and everything like that. But, yeah, as that coalesced and they kind of got that together, what they really adopted was a way that they've been feeding sailors for a long time, you know, and so a lot of what they ended up using, it was the model of, well, this is the way they do it on a ship, and they would have basically a cupboard. Mr. Goodnight Charles Goodnight out in the panhandle of Texas was given credit for first coming up with, as they call it, a cupboard, or it's almost like a chest of drawers with the door that drops down, which becomes the working table for the cook.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a little, it's simple as can be and light. You don't want to add weight to what you're trailing. A little stick which folds out, and then that holds the table up. You got all your pans, some of the bigger pans would be underneath the wagon. You got all your things you needed there, the flour and salt pork sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
If otherwise, they had to, it was just dry food, bags of dried beans. and things like that. But what people don't realize now, which is enjoyable to us when we read these stories back then, is that that tended to be the older person because they knew how to cook. It mm-hmm. might have been as we come to call with novels and everything, a broken down cowboy that couldn't ride 12 hours a day anymore. Or didn't want to, and read a lot of accounts where it was just they picked up a hand from this ranch or that ranch that was known to be a fair cook, and that was going to be their job. Mm-hmm. But they tended to be older, mm-hmm. and they were the ones responsible for getting everybody up. They had groups that would get up at 2 or 3 hour intervals to watch the herd throughout the night. But then, generally, on most became a certain kind of routine in the 1870s, they would get before daylight and get everybody fed and then get the cattle moving right at daylight with many of the groups and get the advantage of the most of your day. And so they were kind of the business person of the group. They didn't just feed.
So they were respected, like a respected part of the drive? Or seems like a really important job.
Yeah, good point. You look at how you're paid. By the mid 1870s to 1880, as that business model coalesced, the trail drover, the guy that was in charge, he got the most money, mm-hmm. and then the second highest paid person was the cook.
Oh, yeah, okay. I mean you're responsible for
feeding
and giving energy. I mean, when you're out and it's desolate, it's about calories and expenditure of energy. And
so when you got later on down the road, as everybody was trying to get the herd moving and everything, the wagon with his mules often and things like that could go at a little bit a better pace. And then he would often, by those later years, be responsible for selecting the next camp. And then he would set up camp and so have things going when they got the cattle there because they moved at, as they call it, a grazing pace. And the other thing that would happen at night, before the as some of the stars came up or whatever, the legendary cook would point the tongue of the wagon to the north, straight north. So even in the dark, then later the trail boss and stuff knew
was.
Straight north. Yeah. But again, the Chisholm Trail wasn't a sidewalk, and if you'd already had at that point of the year 100,000 animals go up at Central Place, there's nothing to eat. It's become desolate, and so they would have to seek their own little bits of trails, and then so it'd be like fingers of trails going up really, and that's why people I get smile when people say, well, show me exactly where Chisholm Trail came through Oklahoma City, or show me exactly what block did they go across, but there's certain places again where like it over in Pinot area or whatever we know there's good places where a lot of them crossed the rivers with, so they'd be going over here, but if they knew there's a good ford, they bring the animals and they cross there and then they go back
spread
where
out
they
a little bit more,
find some good resources for the cattle and their horses. But the cook and the other thing, whether it was on the trail in the later years once it got established or at the ranchers in the later periods of the 1870s, 1880s, there was a lot said, especially in the 1880s, that the better the cook, and we're not talking about French cuisine, mm-hmm. we're talking about things if a guy would often put out, cobblers and things that 18, 22-year-old men thought was great stuff, they would keep a crew. Oftentimes, if half of them got sick once a month, which our sanitary methods now are a lot different than back then, it's hard if you're losing your cowboys all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but so they'd talk among themselves as where's the best, who's got the best cook, which outfit's got the best food, and they would often that would give them one step along with pay. Pay was pretty even across the board, so the cooks had the advantage holding together a better group.
Yeah. Who would be the lowest man on the totem pole?
Again, let's go back to the time when it was in that mid-period when the cattle drive era was at its height. Probably the youngest. A lot of times you would have a wrangler that would be responsible because you'd need numerous horses. Even one cowboy couldn't do that two-month trek on one horse. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't. The horse wouldn't hold up. So they'd need several horses for each cowboy, and so a lot of times he would have a young'un, and that's all they were responsible for is to bring that horse herd.
Wrangle the horses.
Yes, that's where that term comes from.
Yeah. So what was it? Did they have a derogatory name for them?
is this public?
You can say
go ahead. We can edit it out if it's too bad.
The nicest one I can think of is Hoodlum, which they actually used that back then, and they some of them had two wagons, and they would call the second one the Hoodlum wagon, which they would bring along and a young'un who sought firewood, and, you know, because again you wouldn't be able to take enough firewood along for that whole trip, mm-hmm. So it was one of those you just need fuel. And then also just to make sure that he didn't lose the horses. And in some areas, these horses needed protecting and keep them from wandering off and or someone else, as they say, to throw a loop over one of them and to end up with all of a sudden you're missing two or three good horses. And then to move them to the next thing. So that would probably be the youngest person. And again, that's where you look at, that's where you start to see the model of that might have been a 13-year-old boy.
Wow.
Or even 12.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we think, how in the world? Yeah. But yeah, that was the time. We look back, but a lot of people think, and they look at the old biblical times, and they think of they have no problem looking at shepherds. And a lot of the shepherds were 8 years old, things like that, you know, and they were just, go watch the sheep, you know, and,
well,
and keep them from getting in trouble.
Different expectations because life expectancy was a little bit less, you know, so so you're doing different jobs at different times. Yeah.
So, and then I've got there's one image that I love that many people have seen the John Wayne movie, The Cowboys. What you can see some of the, once they got to Kansas, a number of the crews, by far very few, but some photographs exist of where the trail crew showed up at a studio, you know, and got their picture taken as we made it, you know. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorites, most of them have got a little cheroot or cigar in their mouth, you know, and they're young, teenage boys, you know, and they just lived through something. They did it together. They pulled it off, and they're getting their picture taken together. And just sitting there, you know, two or three standing behind the ones, you can tell, okay, that's the boss. That's his second. You know, and you can just look.
The pecking order.
You can read it on their face. You can see it in the quality of the hats, maybe. Mm-hmm. And other things that you get going, I love to do this myself, is all of a sudden I look at the quality of the boots, who spent the most on their equipment, you know, or had the and you can just tell how that worked out. And then you've got the two young'uns right over here. One of them is my favorite pictures, where he's sitting on the boss's knee. And the boss is probably just a really well-put-together 19-year-old. You know, and this other kid is maybe 12. You know, and they've all done it, and it's I love those photos.
Yeah,
I mean that camaraderie that you'd
never yeah.
I don't think we can understand.
No, I can't think of anything that I've done in my life that would be
pull you together
like that
much
with a group of people. You know, I mean, I can.
And there might have been
pretend,
one, like I said, there might have been at least one that they knew that didn't end up there.
Yeah,
you know, they didn't make it.
Yeah, the danger. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about, to me, the most dangerous thing on a cattle drive through popular culture, tell me if it's wrong, is the idea of a stampede.
Well, I'd have to go along with that.
Yeah.
In terms of immediate danger, because you have 2,000 animals. Sometimes they'd scatter widely. Sometimes they'd all take off in the same direction. A lot of it had been on terrain. If you found yourself, and these guys would head off and they'd try to get to the front, as they say, to turn them. It sounds like a movie, but that's really what had to happen if you're going to stop them. You can't stop them from the back.
Right.
You can break a group in two, but that's pretty daggum dangerous, you know, because they're a herd animal. So, and so just depending on where it caught up with you or whatever, if you were riding night herd or whatever and they all started heading toward you, you might find yourself in the middle, and these are over 1,000-pound animals.
I've got a fear/healthy respect of even cows. They're
of just standing, like being in the field with
them. Yeah, they're just such large animals.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And every once in a while you hear about a farmer or a rancher, and if something just goes wrong, and you maybe it's a cow, a mother cow. Uh-huh. You know, we think about this, a mother bear or a mother moose or whatever, but you can have
cows
the same thing with a mother.
Yeah.
You've got a mother cow, and she gets somebody down. Mm-hmm. They can just grind you into the ground, and you know, and they're a hell of a lot bigger than you are, pardon my French. So in the immediate danger, that would be it. But another time is really produced more deaths on the trail was, and it's not firearms. It's when they had to cross so many rivers, and some of them would only be waist deep. Others, especially because it started in the late spring, and you had to go through it across 2 months. Pick your 2 months or whatever. Uh-huh. The earlier on, you had better grass. The later on, maybe less dangerous weather, but less water.
Right. So you have rushing streams.
But sometimes you had there's a good book by Andy Adams called Log of a Cowboy, and he talks quite a bit about that, where they would have to get to certain streams. It might have been the Cimarron, it might have been the Canadians or something like that, and it wasn't raining hard here, but it was raining
upstream,
100 miles away, and that river might be 10 feet deep and running like mad, and if you tried to cross your cattle on that, push your they would go in, they'd be swept downstream, they'd have to swim like mad. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the cowboys then would if they did have to swim the cattle across, where it was hopefully not storm raging but just deep enough, they would come in and you have flank, and that was part of their job, is to keep the cattle. It's the easiest thing to do is just go with the current and to keep them swimming. So they'd kind of swim at an angle a little bit.
To get them across, right, yeah.
It's too hard to swim upstream in current, mm-hmm. and it's almost impossible even
just
for
to
us
straight.
With any current to swim straight across, because the current will take you. So, mm-hmm. But to try to keep them together so you don't have, you lose 10, just float on down the river. Well, those guys sometimes cattle would be caught up into it. Maybe their horse would loose. Maybe they didn't grow up next to a swimming hole.
Yeah,
a lot of them came from parts of Texas where there weren't any natural lakes. And we think about swimming in rivers, and a lot of the rivers you couldn't swim in if you wanted to. They didn't know how to swim. So it's like they lost that horse or couldn't hang on to that horse. Or sometimes the horse and the rider, the cattle, if they got into that mix, the cattle were frantic, and they were trying to swim, and mm-hmm. and they would pull the horse and rider down.
Yeah.
And if you have 20, 100 head across, they wouldn't raise until mm-hmm. They wouldn't come up for air until the rest of the cattle were over. They'd just drive them into the, so that's where most of the young cowboys lost their lives.
Yeah, that image is horrifying.
Yes. to be drowned by cattle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're heading getting near the end, and let's talk about how this period in American history and the Chisholm Trail, do you think that's when the image of the cowboy that later became so popular in literature and pop culture, you think that's when it's kind of solidified?
I don't know whether I could put it better. Yeah, I do. But as to put flesh on that, as in the early 1870s, as cowboys started to, not just Abilene, that was a pretty raw bunch, but then you get to Newton and Wichita and then Dodge City, and the stories started getting to the rest of the world, and newspaper men and some newspaper women, there were a few notable ones, would come and they would witness the herders that would come in, the drovers, and how colorful they were, how young and adventurous they were. And you can imagine some of them hadn't even seen hardly a tree once they got mm-hmm. out to the Dodge City and the actual Chisholm Trail part, and they all of a sudden they get handed, $100 or something like that. And $100 in 1870, four was, for a young person who'd never seen maybe no more than, $5 or $10 in their whole lifetime, mm-hmm. they could get pretty wild and so the stories went back to the newspapers and the rest of the world and everything. And what we don't realize now, a lot of times what you'd see in the press now, there was these colorful and wild and really these half horse, half man people, and they would call them cow-boys. Cowboys, but the hyphen was usually there through almost 1900. And what we don't realize now, when we go back and read some of the books and some of the coffee table books about these early cowboys and stuff like that, is when they used that term, it was generally, and the writers and stuff weren't out in the middle of the trek and stuff and saw the boredom and mundane and life and that. They just saw the partying at the end of the trail at the payoff. It was really a derogatory term. In some ways, it was in some areas of the country, even Montana and out in Arizona and stuff, it was equated to wrestler. In others, it was at least ruffian, but not admirable, drover, or cattleman. Cattleman connoted that you owned the cattle.
Right. And that's okay, but you just can't be the people that are actually doing the work.
Yeah. And, the younger single guys are generally the ones that usually got the rowdiest and got in trouble. There's nothing new, and same thing goes on today. But, it was until 1900, it was usually a term of derision, a cowboy. So that early, the mid-1870s, in Dodge City, the highlight of Dodge City, from 1877 to 1884. That's when a lot of the public, when writers would come back from Philadelphia, Boston, these other places, that's when they started to be given through words and through engravings some visuals of who these people were, what they did. And it really had nothing to do with the similar type of a drover or a vaquero, buckaroo over in California. It was a different phenomenon over here at Chisholm Trail. And that's where that popular image of the wild and unruly cowboy started back then, the 1870s, and then captured the mind of a lot of fictional writers and just grew from there on to the movies.
That idea was so romantic to people on the East Coast.
They couldn't, they just couldn't imagine, what life would be like or, uncivilized. the whole world would be.
We're back.
Thank you, Don. That was
enlightening.
Yeah, always. He's a great guy.
Yeah. I actually I had a lot more questions about cowboying than I thought I would. I didn't realize how interested I would be in the topic, but you don't think about all the ins and outs and the dirtiness.
I never thought about how rough, they might have a little pup tent or something, but it's not, if it rains, you're in the wet and you're in the elements for months.
Yeah, you're just stuck out there. And you can't hop into your Jeep and go back to the city. Do you have any favorite, what you would call cowboy foods? Like what you think of
I only think, food? I think of like beans.
Beans.
Pinto beans.
Steak. Beef jerky.
Beef jerky.
Mm-hmm.
Biscuits.
Yeah. Coffee.
Ooh, cowboy coffee. Man, I'll bust out the percolator instead of making the normal.
Do the percolator? Do you put a little some pine needles in there?
No, I used to love what is it? The pinion. I lived in New Mexico for a little while, and pinion wood coffee, very good.
Or chicory.
Let's talk about next week's podcast. We're going to find out why you sound funny.
Why I sound funny?
Yeah.
Why you sound funny?
We're doing an episode on Oklahoma accents, and we have a linguist coming in, and so we're going to talk about why we sound.
The way we do?
The way we do. And who we are. It's kind of a big...
Oh, that's very existential.
Is it? I think it's very stential. Yeah, so it's the Friday before Thanksgiving, and we've all got... are you taking off?
I am. I'm taking off, and...
You're going to be gone all next week. I'm going to be here maybe one day. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, and if you have time this holiday season, the museum will be open.
Yeah, pop into the Oklahoma History Center and come on in and visit.
Yeah, Saturday after Thanksgiving. And right now we have the Vietnam exhibit. That's the latest one. Yeah,
Oklahomans in Vietnam, and mixes Oklahomans who served in Vietnam with Vietnamese immigrants. And it's great exhibit.
Yeah, so come out and see us. Bye, partner. Wait, that sounded too southern. Bye, partner.
Bye, partner.